Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
A war has broken out. This time, it's between the Central Intelligence Agency and Senate Democrats. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. This week, Senator Dianne Feinstein, chair of the Intelligence Committee, accused the CIA of secretly removing documents, searching computers used by the committee, and attempting to intimidate congressional investigators by requesting the FBI look into their conduct. California Democrat called this a defining moment for Congress's oversight role of the intelligence community. Meanwhile, CIA Director John Brennan fired back, saying that, in his words, a lot of people who are claiming that there has been this tremendous sort of spying and monitoring and hacking will be proved wrong. Much of the argument revolved around what's been called an internal review ordered by former CIA Director Leon Panetta. Feinstein has said her committee is about to deliver a 6,000-page report and will push for declassification of its executive summary that looks at the interrogation techniques used during the Bush administration after 9/11. Take a look at the implications of this dispute. Our in-studio guest is Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Well, let me ask you this. First of all, just overall as an impression, what do you make of this dispute that is clearly broken out, is very acrimonious? And we should mention, by the way, that Dianne Feinstein, senator from California, has really been a bit of a defender of the CIA and the intelligence community in general.
There's a term popular in political science called the socialization of conflict. And this is a prime example of the socialization of conflict, meaning that what Dianne Feinstein essentially has done has gone public regarding that heretofore has been largely a private dispute, a private wrangling for information between the CIA and the Senate Committee, Intelligence Committee. What that means is basically that Feinstein, expressing, I'm sure, the concerns of a number of other senators on the Intelligence Committee and, of course, the staff, is that they have had real difficulty getting cooperation from the CIA, getting information from the CIA to examine essentially the torture program that the CIA was overseeing during the Bush administration. And what has happened here is that Feinstein really went public to get pressure from other senators, from the media. The media is very important, I think, in this struggle. And, of course, to try to appeal to President Obama to get more cooperation and, of course, to push for declassification of the report once they have finally finished it.
Now, much of this, to sort of get in the weeds just a little, but much of this revolves around what's called the Panetta Review, which is basically sort of a way to sort of sift through all the documents to make to find things, is basically what it amounted to. Now, there's some dispute as to whether it's a review or whether it was just that he ordered people to go ahead and figure a better way to keep track of the memos. And then there's a dispute over the computers and whether the CIA computers as opposed to the committee computers and so on. And as a matter of fact, one of the explanations, one of the pushbacks from Brennan seemed to indicate that this was a lot murkier than what people thought in terms of its details, and therefore we're really down there as opposed to any great broad conflict. What do you make of this sort of weeds conflict or arguments that are now going on between the Senate on the one hand and the CIA on the other? I mean, you see this camouflage, you see it as a real dispute, or some, if you read it the right way, you could even see it as being a misunderstanding.
I think that the CIA does not want this report to become public. They wish to discredit whatever the Senate committee has come up with in terms of this report. So that the struggle here really has to do with the credibility of the report, getting it declassified so it becomes public. Because clearly, if this report becomes public, or I hope once it does become public, it will be a damning document of the Bush administration's running of the interrogation program. And, you know, in one sense, like any agency of the government, they struggle to retain their credibility, their practices, and this will harm the CIA's reputation, clearly. And I think that's why the CIA has worked to drag its feet in cooperating with the documents. And in this particular document, the Panetta Review, from what we can understand so far, is that it will help to corroborate what the committee's report will say, right? And hence why a copy of that, a hard copy of that, is now in a safe in the Senate, right? And again, you have this classic struggle here between the legislative branch attempting to perform its oversight and accountability function, and then the executive branch really trying to be more independent. And hence, really, I think Feinstein has put it well. This is, you know, it's a defining moment of whether or not the Senate, the legislative branch, will be able to hold executive branch agencies accountable. And that's very important for any claim to have a democratic society, I think.
And we should mention that the contention by the Senate Democrats is that the Panetta Review backs the idea that the torture techniques were not effective, that they did not get that kind of information that they wanted from them. And apparently that was the view, at least of some folks in the CIA, towards that particular issue.
Yes.
And I guess it raises the issue about, because the argument has been made for particularly for the torture, is it was effective. It got us bin Laden. It got us, you know, to stop terrorist attacks.
That's exactly right. And if, I mean, the Panetta Review is the review of the then CIA director, Leon Panetta. So it's an internal review. And if that is missing, if that's not around, well, then what does the report have to rest on? Whereas with that report, right, the Senate report gains credibility.
And by the way, now, how do you assess, by the way, the Obama administration and how it has handled it? Because one of the things that the administration said is that it was going to look forward. I mean, it did take a look back, took a look at some things, and what you get is a situation where the acting counsel for the CIA was also involved in, as an attorney, in terms of overseeing some of the justification for these particular techniques. It seems as if there's this hangover that there was not as great of a change, perhaps, as some people had thought.
Well, in effect, it strikes me as a sad commentary on the Obama administration. Rather than doing the heavy lifting of pursuing what went wrong with these programs, from the president's point of view, basically, like a lot of presidents before, they leave the past to the past. And with the Senate report, the Senate committee, they have had to do the dirty work, in effect, of saying, well, we're going to actually explore this in great detail. And instead, the Obama administration has tended to, I mean, they've kept a lot of folks. I mean, Brennan was part of the Bush administration as well. So you have a lot of these Bush administration figures remaining at the agency rather than turning over a new leaf. So I think that some blame can be placed on Obama's shoulders for not doing what he should have done when he first came into office, to really explore what had happened and to help facilitate. I mean, this is years in coming, right? This report, this kind of examination should have been made public long ago, in my estimation. And that could have happened if the Obama administration had really been helping the Senate Intelligence Committee do its work.
Now, Chris, we're looking at this from 2014, right after the 9/11 attacks. Vice President Dick Cheney famously said that in order to fight this war, we would have to get on the dark side of things, because this is where those other people, the enemies, live. And there was a sense, certainly I can appreciate with the Bush administration officials, of we cannot let this happen again. We have to do everything possible. And in that moment, is it really surprising that the nation utilized these kinds of techniques, whether they were right or wrong? We understand the constitutional issue. The Constitution is not, as one somebody famously said, a suicide pact, which is, I'm sure, what Cheney was thinking. But we had to do this. It may not have been effective in the end as we look back, but from that standpoint, what do you think?
Well, it's always the defining moment of how civilized a government you have. And, I mean, it's not the case. I mean, it's the the argument that torture is necessary, right? That debate has been around for quite some time. We have plenty of evidence prior to that that it has not been. And so a president coming into office, and when Bush was president, it was a defining moment for what kind of president was he going to be? Was he going to be a civilized president, or was he going to turn to a barbaric form of interrogation? So I think that we didn't have to do it. The kind of judgment that was made by Cheney and Bush, I think, ought to be condemned. And Obama should have cleaned it up.
Do you think in some ways, in terms of the Bush administration, do you think that this was an expression of the frustration by many conservatives that the United States seemed to be hemmed in, that it didn't seem to be able to do anything that it want, that they thought should be strong? I mean, it reaches like prior to that. For instance, there was a discussion early on in the administration. There's a meeting, I guess it was, with Bush and his national security folks. I think Paulson, I think, was there. And there's this famous scene where they're talking about the Middle East. And Bush says, well, you know, what can we do? And then somebody says, well, we could do something about Iraq. And then Bush essentially says, well, okay, well, find a way for me to get rid of Saddam Hussein. Now, there were some sanctions fatigue that was clearly setting in at that point. That was going to be his problem no matter what. But there was this frustration that they were being hemmed in by all these sort of Lilliputians, these little tiny powers. And here we are, the United States, the greatest power in the world, militarily as well as economically, and yet we didn't seem to be able to do anything. And that was a frustration on the part of conservatives, which then kind of spread out into this reaction, of course, to 9/11.
Unquestionably. I mean, the hawks that were brought into the government with the Bush administration had long sought some rationale for invading Iraq. I mean, those plans had been laid long before 9/11, and so that the sense of using the military as not just the last instrument of power, but really as one of the first instruments of power, was part of the ideological thinking, I think, of the hawks that came in with Bush. So unquestionably, I mean, I think that we 9/11 occurs. These programs then are created and implemented, and then the planning goes forward for the invasion of a country that had nothing to do with 9/11, had not threatened the United States. It was clearly a war of aggression by the United States in Iraq, and again fomented and implemented by an ideological perspective that emphasized really a militaristic view of foreign policy.
I mean, it does seem as if that, I mean, not only on the Iraq side, but even domestically, that there was a frustration that there were all these limits about what you could do and respond, particularly to 9/11, which was sort of a new event, although there had been terrorist attacks previously to that as well, the attack on the ship, the USS Cole, and so on. So, but there was a certain frustration, I think, that seemed to be building up on a whole array of fronts.
Yes.
You think so?
Yeah, I do. I do. I mean, I think that's true. I think there's a broader sense that we were being perceived that we were the paper tiger, and we had to reassert a forceful, particularly in foreign policy, but even in domestic policy. I think it was part of the ideology as well.
Now, as you see this dispute, moving back to the committee and this dispute with the CIA, what kind of constitutional issues do you see playing out here?
I think Feinstein raised Fourth Amendment issues, and I think that has to do with whether or not the CIA, without authorization, investigated the computers of the committee staffers, which could be a question of whether or not there was an unreasonable search and seizure, because there were actual documents too that claimed to have been taken out. The other, I think, perhaps more importantly, I think, is the whole question of accountability to the legislative branch. If the, I mean, because we don't know how this is really going to play out yet, right? If this report sees the light of day, if it does see the light of day, and the committee staffers are indeed held free from prosecution, as the CIA would like them, what they want to pursue prosecution, then we have seen a victory for the legislative branch being able to hold an agency accountable, right? If, on the other hand, this report does not see the light of day, or major sections are redacted or taken out of the report, right? Which is possible, because, again, whether the White House has yet to really weigh in forcefully, it seems to me, on this issue, then we have a constitutional failure, in effect, because what that would mean is that the executive branch agency, in this case the CIA, has been able to get away with not only pursuing a perhaps unlawful but certainly morally unjustified program, but keeping it private, keeping it secret, keeping it classified information. So I think, and that will put precedence, because again, what is unprecedented here is for the chair of this intelligence committee, right, to take this clearly public, okay, like it's never been done before on the Senate floor. And she's clearly taken a risk, right? And if she fails in that effort, right, that will say a lot for going forward, whether other senators in similar kinds of positions would be willing to put their necks out on the line for that.
Well, it seems to me that we're at a moment in time that may be similar to, say, the 1970s, in which, for instance, the Church hearings, they investigated the CIA and found, mm-hmm. obviously, there were the assassination mm-hmm. plots, amongst others, a whole slew of things that clearly the CIA and clearly the executive branch was not telling Congress. I mean, that's very clear. And then that led to some restructuring and some creation of oversight and so on. Do you think we're going to be hitting that kind of period again, where you're going to have Congress perhaps implement some kind of new rules and regulations, or at least attempt to do so?
One would think that I mean, if again, we have to wait to see what this report says, right? But if the report is as damning as the initial indications seem to indicate, then the consequence for the logic of that report would be we need to put in place some new rules and regulations that will make sure that this never, ever happens again. Because Feinstein was very strong in her comments, right? This should never, never, never have been in place in the first place. What are the prospects of that actually happening? Hard to say necessarily, but I mean, some indications, I mean, Senator John McCain, I think, certainly has been one who has argued against torture, as being one who has experienced it firsthand. So would you get bipartisan support for new regulations? I think it's possible within the Senate. The kind of cooperation you would get from the House of Representatives remains questionable, though. But also is the question in my mind is how far the Obama administration wants to go on this, because we have to keep in mind Brennan and his cohorts in the CIA, they have been the holdovers from the Bush administration into the Obama administration. And will Obama then, in the face of a damning report, really, what would he be doing then in terms of his folks within the CIA? Because they will resist. I mean, I think the CIA would continue to resist this. But they may not be able to resist successfully once the ball gets rolling and it becomes clear and becomes a public issue. Then more could be done.
Do you think that in some ways that the situation with the CIA is sort of... In part, it seems to be an issue for its own little turf. On the other hand, it's clearly these programs were carried out under an administration that approved it. And we get this, I mean, throughout the CIA's history. For instance, in the 1950s, for example, we had the Dulles brothers. One was Secretary of State, one was head of the CIA. And those two entities in the administration went hand in hand in those kinds of activities. But then you kind of then tend to move away, and then you tend to come back. I mean, how much separation do you think there is between the CIA and any given administration, or is this a cyclical thing that's going on?
I think that there's the national security establishment has been institutionalized really since National Security Act 1947. I mean, I think that's when you get these institutions being more integrated, more solidly rooted. And I think that there tends to be, from one administration to another, a tendency to be protective of those national security agencies. I mean, even if they come in with some skepticism, I mean, with the pressure, I think the pressure on any new president, particularly a young president like Obama, I think he came in with skepticism, but he clearly got persuaded to have these holdovers. I think there is actually an institutional sense of the executive branch presidents being protective, first of all. But in the light of these kinds of exposures of damaging programs, they may be forced to take some action. But again, we'll have to see what happens.
Because I was reminded of actually Saxby Chambliss, who's a member of the committee, he actually confronted Feinstein a bit. And one of the quotes was, he says, the Republican committee members on the Senate Intelligence Committee and staff were not involved in the underlying investigation, the detainee and interrogation report. Now, they signed on to the idea of having this investigation initially, but apparently they said, no, we're not going to be involved with it. What does that say about the political institutions and the political parties at this point? I mean, is it just that Republicans, in your view, are trying to protect the previous president? Are they trying to protect the intelligence? I mean, what makes the difference here between the Democratic Party on the one hand, who was looking at this, and has their own president there as well, as opposed to, say, the Republicans? I mean, is it just a partisan thing, or do you think...
I think it's both partisan and ideological. It's partisan in that I think that certainly the sense of protection of the Bush administration's reputation and historical legacy, because this report will damage that, I think, if it becomes public. I think it's ideological in the sense that I think that certain members of the Republican Party tend to be more supportive of keeping things secret, keeping much of what goes on with the CIA secret from the public. So transparency is less important, I think, less important to them than it is to, say, liberal Democrats. And I think this is a dividing line. His response really was, she should not have taken this public. And so what's the alternative? He just wanted to keep it in the back rooms and negotiate and work out any of the tensions and the problems between the committee and the CIA. Whereas what Feinstein did was, as I say, she socialized this conflict. She has made it public. So now it's in the public arena and the media. And in one sense, I mean, thank goodness for the media in a sense of a democratic society, because the media can help hold executive agencies accountable for their actions. And that's what this is all about. So I do think there is an interesting ideological, less democratic position with a small d in the Republican circles here. I mean, they prefer to keep this secret. And that's not good for us as American citizens.
Well, talking about the idea about secrecy and democracy, David Korn within Mother Jones, he wrote this. He says, what Feinstein didn't say, but it's surely implied that without effective monitoring, secret government cannot be justified in a democracy. Feinstein has ripped open a scab to reveal a deep wound that has been festering for years. The president needs to respond in a way that demonstrates he is serious about making the system work and restoring faith in the oversight of the intelligence establishment. This is more than a spies versus DC turf. It is a constitutional crisis. Do you think it's a constitutional crisis?
I don't know if it's a crisis, but I think it is certainly a critical point that he makes. I mean, I agree with his analysis there that to the extent that you can justify secret programs of any sort, secret programs run by agencies cannot be secret to everybody, right? The difference between a dictatorship and a democracy is that your decision makers, your elected officials, know what is going on, right? And can call agencies to account, which means not only making them explain, but if you don't like what they do, you can change it, right? And if you can't, if you don't know what they're doing, there's no way you can change it. If you don't know what's going on, you can't think about whether or not to change it. So I think accountability, democratic accountability, is clearly at issue here. And again, with David Corn's point, if we lose this one, right, if the committee, in fact, if their position fails to succeed, then that sets a precedent going forward. Then basically, not only the CIA, but other agencies like the NSA and all the other secret agencies of the government can go forward without much worry that they'll be held to account for their actions.
Do you think that a democracy can survive or operate with this kind of secrecy? I mean, with secrecy in general, outside of the general diplomatic, because this moves beyond just simply the diplomacy, mm-hmm. for instance, that Thomas Jefferson talked about when he was president, that, yeah, you have to keep some things, negotiations secret and so on, right? But obviously this is now far beyond that. Can a democracy carry out these kinds of intelligence gathering operations and survive? I mean, are these compatible? I guess that's what I would say, compatible.
In my view, no. I mean, I think that's what we're seeing here with this particular case is the culmination of an expansion of secrecy over democracy, and hence a major conflict here. And I think that transparency is critical for democracy, that we citizens, we only have an ability to influence what our government does if we know what the government is doing. So claims of secrecy prevent us from doing that. So I think now what that means for the future in terms of whether secret programs or the CIA institution like the Central Intelligence Agency, I mean, again, we have to keep in mind these are fairly modern institutions, right? They haven't always existed. Should they always exist? I mean, that's a larger theoretical kind of question. But I think we should be raising those kinds of questions and examining the consequences of continuing to have them or changing them in radical ways. This particular episode gives us another opportunity, like the church hearings did, as you referred to. This provides us with an opportunity to at the very least, rein in some of the worst practices of these agencies and force them to understand that transparency going forward is going to be the rule of the day, not secrecy.
Because one of the things that actually struck me as I'm sitting here is that the CIA, the modern intelligence agency that we looked at, and it could be the NSA as well, these are in many ways a product of the Cold War. I mean, certainly the Central Intelligence Agency was a product of the Cold War, in which, okay, now we had to fight this sort of global war, although it comes out of the Second World War and fighting the Nazis with the OSS. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, these are institutions, the NSA and so on, are institutions that really were created during that period. And now the Cold War is over, the Soviet Union is gone. Do you think that any of these kinds of programs or any of these agencies will be ratcheted down at all? Or do you think we live in such an uncertain world that the U.S. government and any administration, is going to say, no, we need to know more and we need to carry out not only intelligence gathering, but obviously covert operations as well? We won't necessarily get into the whole drone program, but that's an extension of this.
Absolutely.
Much different view of the world as it was, say, before, say, the 1940s?
I'm pessimistic about that. I think that the intelligence establishment is perhaps stronger than ever before. I think that the prevailing ideology that guides not simply Republicans but also Democrats is that we need these programs. We need to have intelligence. I mean, the Obama has been quite defending the national security agencies, eavesdropping, and of course pursuing the drone program and special forces. And in terms of asserting, projecting power and military power in that direction, and that requires intelligence gathering and secrecy and spying going forward. And I don't see, I mean, if you look across the board, I mean, would a Clinton presidency, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, what ideological perspective does she bring to bear on that? It's more, it's the same, if not even more aggressive than what Obama has. So, are there some folks within the left side of the Democratic Party who certainly have some critique, but they're more marginal to this. So I think that going forward, again, ratcheting back setting more narrow parameters within which these agencies can operate, yes, but I don't see at this point any radical restructuring or rethinking of the need for spying going forward.
I mean, and it does strike me that given the sort of the era of the sort of the stateless enemy as opposed to the state enemies which we faced in the prior, that I suspect that what's going to happen is that we'll probably see a continuation certainly of these institutions, not only as institutions because they have institutional grounding, but also that they'll probably be seen as useful in this sort of new war that I think that many administrations probably will think is important for them to use in these kinds of conflicts. We've been speaking with Michael Laughlin. He's a political science professor at Salisbury University, and we've been talking about the war that's broken out between the CIA and the Senate Democrats. I appreciate you taking the time to stop by.
My pleasure.
Up next, we're going to talk about a novel called Elizabeth's Field. It's about a group of free blacks who lived in Dorchester County in the 1840s and 1850s. We'll be talking with the author. This is Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. And we'll be back in a moment. The novel is called Elizabeth's Field, and it's about a group of free blacks who lived in Dorchester County during the 1840s and 1850s. Welcome back to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Elizabeth is a free woman of Indian and African American descent who owns 22 acres of land from about 1852 and then loses it in about 1857. Now, the novel tells a story of her efforts to hold on to the land and of the lives, both free and slaves, of those who lived in her world. And one of the most notable, of course, is Sam Green. He's a local black minister who was sentenced to 10 years eventually in prison for owning a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin. The work itself is based on the recollections of Maddie, a present-day farm worker. And in our studio is the author, Barbara Lockhart. She spent 9 years writing and researching for this novel. She's also received artist awards in fiction from the Maryland Arts Council for her novels, Requiem for a Summer and Elizabeth's Field. She is retired now after teaching early child education for about 25 years. And well, welcome to the program, first of all.
Thank you very much.
So I want to first of all direct our attention to the setting. As that what was Dorchester County like, and the kind of place that it was where these events unfold?
The land is character in my book, because the land is always a place where people struggle against and try to make a living. And when I first moved here years and years ago, we had a summer cottage on the Choptank River. And I used to watch the kids in the water playing. And across the river, directly across, was this old brick mansion that was very sad and dark. And I always wondered about what went on there. And I never had a clue as to actually what was happening. But it was part of the history of this land, and what happens here on the shore is so unique because it doesn't change all that much. The physical structures are still there. The empty fields, for example, where Harriet Tubman was born, those fields are still there and unchanged. there's that. And then I don't know why, but when I moved here, I was so aware of the fact that the marshes and the grasslands would be a good place for a runaway. I don't know why. I had no background to think that way, but it was just something I knew deep inside that I would someday write about, because the land is so unique.
What is it about the land that really sets up this story? Because on the one hand, we're very close to the north, and that's mm-hmm. where, and yet there are a number of free blacks in the area. As a matter of fact, there was an excavation actually going on, at least in Easton, in a neighborhood called The Hill, which is now believed to be the earliest free black neighborhood. How is it that you had this sort of groups of free blacks, also still had slavery, and you were also very close to the north? I mean, it all seemed to sort of come together.
It was quite a mix of northern and southern sentiment, but I would say that in Dorchester County and on the eastern shore, the sentiment was more southern. In our county particularly, and in some of the surrounding counties, there were far more free blacks than slaves. And probably the answer to that was because the farmers were poorer. And that does not mean to say that there were no plantations with hundreds of slaves, because there were. But in our county especially, because of the economic factor, a poor white farmer might have one or two or three slaves. And if he had a bad year, he would simply sell one of them and carry on. But the idea of the free black, the farmer, the poor farmer, would work in the fields with the free blacks. And so they became more like family. There was always the feeling of protecting these people. I shouldn't say always, because it wasn't true of everybody, but there were many families who really took care of the black population when they became free, even though the free blacks had far more terrible time existing, because they didn't own land, they only rented it, they were not allowed to put their crops up for sale unless they joined a white farmer. They had so many restrictions, but the fact that there was a much larger population of free blacks was unique in this area.
Yeah, I was struck by this sort of tension that constantly exists, that there's this shadow that sort of hangs over this group of African Americans, of this sort of white culture and white community, some of whom were certainly decent in their own way, I suppose. But on the other hand, it was always seems to be a fear that constantly exists. Is that a good reading?
Absolutely. There was so much anxiety in a free black. I mean, he was so restricted, he or she was so restricted. They couldn't be more than 10 miles from where they lived without papers to prove that they were free. The law really did not speak to the free black population. The sheriff decided, and he would throw them in jail if there was any kind of problem. So their freedom was not freedom as we know it. And their freedom was very hard won through the years.
Now tell me a bit about Maddie, because you open with the first chapter is with her. And I take it she's sort of passed on, but she's talking about her life, and she's actually interspersed throughout the entire novel. Mm-hmm. Tell me, how did you come across her? I mean, I understand she's a real person, and indeed mm-hmm. many of these people are. Well, how did that happen?
Maddie lived down the road from me, and her name was really Mary Taylor. And she would always flag people because she had a big garden and she was always willing to share what she had. She lived in something that looked more like a shack than a dwelling. And she obviously was very poor. She was an older woman when I met her. She was in her late 70s and early 80s. And yet, in the summertime, she always had plenty to share. And she had worked on the farm where she lived on the edge of the field. Well, she always would, as I say, she had plenty of lettuce. Mm-hmm. Hey, right. Stop and get some lettuce, some strawberries, or whatever she had to share. And one day, when I was talking to her, she said, you know, I stabbed my husband. And I was like, okay, I cannot walk by this. And I said, oh, Mary, tell me more. And she right. said, when I've done weeding my garden, you come back and I'll tell you. And she did, and she shared her whole life. And it was really quite an education for me. I taped her voice, I took notes, I transcribed it, and all of that record is now in the Maryland Archives, or Maryland State Archives, a fact of which she was very proud of. But I'm very grateful to her, because I could not have written this book without her voice. and it was her voice that guided me. And Mary's family was scattered. She right. did not raise her own children, unfortunately. And her grandmother was a slave and relieved or freed at 14. And she always wanted to talk about that with her grandmother. And her grandmother would say, "That's behind me now. I don't want to talk about it." And Mary always wondered what happened before that. So when I got to constructing the novel, it occurred to me that by having Mary speak from the afterlife, it was possible for her to go back and find out what happened. And of course, all of that is fictionalized.
Right. Well, let me ask you this. So what the key figure, seems to me, is Elizabeth, who apparently was free. And she is married to Perry Burton, who is a slave, at least at the time of the when the book begins. Tell me a little bit about Elizabeth. And she's a clearly the sort of the key figure in all of this. And there's a certain strength to her. I mean, indeed, mm-hmm. a number of the women in the novel, there's a certain strength that she's bearing up no matter what life mm-hmm. throws at her.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mary, Maddie in the book, and Elizabeth are very much alike in that way, strong women who could make do no matter what. And Elizabeth, being a free Negress and owning land, to me, was quite a phenomenon in that age. And so I knew very little about her when I started. I knew that her name appeared different ways on the deed. It was Burton, then it was Buxton, then it was Boston, which kind of said that nobody really cared what the last name was. And I knew, I had her copy of her will, and I knew that she left her land to, and I'm quoting now, "the colored girl who I raised." That told me she did not have children. The manumission paper where she bought her husband and freed him. And then there was a notice in the paper about when she died and the land was put up for auction. That was really all I had. The rest is fictionalized about Elizabeth. With Sam Green and with Maddie, I took those facts and put them in the book. But with Elizabeth, her story is fictionalized. And because our farm is between two main Indian settlements, the Nanticoke and the Choptank, it was very easy to assume that she could be part Indian. What happened when the Indian population was leaving the area or disintegrating as a tribe, many of the Indians joined the free blacks in their communities. And so what happened in the census, there are no Indians recorded as Indians. They simply were put in with the free blacks. So it was very possible for her to be part Indian, as many of the families are in our area. With that, I was able to make her knowledgeable about the kinds of food and how to survive in a rural area. And also because our area was a part of the Underground Railroad, and Sam Green only lived maybe 2 miles away, that it was possible she could be part of the Underground Railroad as well.
So she as we said, she's married to Perry Burton, who's slaved, and then he's ultimately freed.
Yes.
And you have a situation where there are others in the book where they might be free. They might have been freed, but their children still lived in slavery. Tell me about that institution. Illustrate that for me.
Because that happened to Sam Green.
Yeah.
He bought his wife, and some say, I've read one occasion where he bought her for a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, they had two children while the mother was still a slave, and those children remained slaves even after he bought his wife and manumitted her, freed her. The children, Sam Green Jr., worked for a man outside of East New Market, and he took on the trade as a blacksmith, which was a very fortunate thing to be able to do, to have a skill. And he was beaten a lot, and he ran away. And he was in touch with Harriet Tubman, who helped him get all the way to Canada. The daughter, as punishment, when suspicion began to arise about Sam Green's situation, she was sold to a place in Missouri and never seen again. So there was no control over your own children. But Sam Green and his wife took in children of other runaways, as did Elizabeth, because there were children who were left by people who had run away or they died. And the scary thing about the children is that there was always the orphan's court. And if a child did not have a steady name and a steady home and a mother present or a father, they could be taken and indentured. And this existed even up until 1867. The Civil War ended in 65, Emancipation Proclamation in 64, but it took our area, and not just Dorchester, but the surrounding counties, to get rid of the law that said those children could be kept in indenture. There was a letter, I came across a letter in the National Archives, a woman in Caroline County who had written to her senator to plead with him to please get her child back because that child was still in indenture. And that was as late as 1867, as I said. So there was danger for the children all the time.
Well, now, interesting about Sam Bream, who is a real person, we should add, is that you paint him in the novel, and he sort of has two faces, lives two lives. On the one hand, he has to deal with the white community, and he's very demurring, very deferring to it. On the other hand, you know that there's a lot of other things going on. He's trying to help his community. It's almost as if he really represents this individual who's trying to keep everything together, and he has to live in both worlds, as it were.
It was, and I think that's why I think he was a very brave man. He did fit in with the local white farmers, and he was a very hard worker, and he was respected because of that. He also was educated. He could read, and he taught in the basement of his church. He taught kids to read, but he also was an agent for the Underground Railroad. And his ties to Harriet Tubman are not quite clear. His last name, of course, is Green, and Harriet Tubman's mother was a Green. Hmm. So you just don't always know how these people are connected. But he did live two lives. And during that time, he was invited to go to these conventions in Baltimore and Philadelphia and be part of that Methodist abolitionist movement. Now, the church itself was split in two. Couldn't decide which side to come out on officially. But he was, of course, on the side of the freedom of the slaves. But he also came back into his community, and he was the center of that community. And he even made a trip to Canada to visit his son when he had run away. So when it came about that he was under suspicion, it was like, okay, here's a guy who can read. He's educated. He has ties with Philadelphia and Baltimore. It just was all against him in the end. But he was a man of great faith, and he kept moving, even though I think he had moments of doubt.
Well, it's interesting because in the book anyway, they don't get him for being part of the Underground Railroad. But he accepts his fate anyway, because he, as we mentioned a moment ago, he's really convicted of being this, having a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin. But in the character in the book, it doesn't matter. He thinks, well, that they caught me. I mean, explain how you came about that.
Guilty. Yeah,
he's dead. Yeah.
Well, you know, he was acquitted for the first trial because they said the train schedules that we found and the letters that we found in his home are not strong enough evidence and they're not incendiary material. So he was acquitted. And even before he left the jail, they decided, no, that he was going to be convicted on reading that terrible book.
Right.
But he knew how to play the game, and they never could catch him at being an Underground Railroad agent. That's why they resorted to the book.
The book, they finally got him. Although he only spent a few years, I think, in prison, right?
I think he spent four. He was sentenced to 10, and of course the Civil War ended, and then he was freed.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the other interesting sort of characters, the white characters, there's a whole range. I mean, you've got somebody like Shadrach Morris, who, you know, he doesn't really care. I mean, he's sort of out of the Paddy Cannon kind of, I don't care, I'm just going to pass them. You know, if I find somebody who's black, I'll sell them into slavery. On the other hand, you have others who may own slaves, but they're described by the black characters in the book as being kind. And of course, you have those who are just simply brutal. Explain that how you came to that range of white folks there.
Well, I was in a workshop with John Creighton, our local historian. He's the one that really opened my eyes to the fact that the range of possibilities in the population was enormous, because we had the abolitionists, the Quaker settlement in Preston. We had slaves, we had very wealthy landowners, we had the professionals in East Newmarket, the lawyers and the doctors. We had the free blacks, we had Indians. I mean, it was such a conglomeration, and the relationships were very complicated because a man working in his field with his blacks that he had hired or that he had as slaves, he sort of looked out for them for the rest of their lives. And there was a reciprocal relationship. There was one, for example, where, if you don't mind me reading a short section, what happened was the woman, Abby, lost her husband. He was kidnapped. Let me see if I can find that particular one. He was kidnapped, and what happened was he disappeared so suddenly, and she had a baby just at that same time. Now, I don't know if I can find it.
Right, is he right? Was it James Spry, I guess it was, who disappeared?
James Spry disappeared, and yet John Prowse came to the house and expected her to come to his house because his wife was poorly, and she just had a baby. And so she was expected to feed that baby, and she didn't want to do it, of course. But he comes and gets her, and it's an expected thing. There was no question that she was not going to do it. And yet when they're riding in the wagon and going to his farm and it's snowing, he says to her, "Are you warm enough, Abby?" So it was kind of this caring, you know, there was a caring on both sides. And it did happen between some of the poor farmers and the people that worked for them.
Now, I should mention that James Spry, he is Addie's husband, and he is kidnapped. And tell me a little bit about that, because that's how Maddie's family finds its way to Georgia. And I think she's actually part of the Georgia line. And mm-hmm. so that this family gets split up.
Mm-hmm. Well, James Spry is essential to the whole book because he is the tie between the families, and all of that is fictionalized.
Right.
That was not historical evidence that I found at all. But he was a skilled man, as I said before, and he was kidnapped by a man who was a wheelwright.
Right.
And he was poor, and he had a lot of debt, and he needed money. It was very easy to knock somebody over their head and bring them down to Vienna and put them on a ship that would go south and collect $2,000 for a man who was in his prime. And with that, he was able to buy his farm and proceed with his life. August Woodson is the man of conscience. I think about him as the white conscience in the book, that he knew he did something terribly wrong, and it really got him in the end.
So in terms of this sort of microcosm now that we're sort of describing, how would you describe how it was all held together? I mean, because on the one hand, you talk about how it almost seems as if there's all these personal relationships. I mean, there are mm-hmm. obviously some economic ones as well, mm-hmm. and eventually they grab the land. It seems it's very, very complicated. I mean, perhaps because people knew each other. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there were these deep hatreds that ran through it as well.
Mm-hmm. And there was really no trust. It was very difficult to trust people back then. But it seemed to me that because that's why it took me 9 years to get all these facts together
right.
and get it in a tapestry of different voices. But I thought about it in terms of concentric circles, that on the outside was the country, what the civil rights and the slavery issue and all of that, and then coming closer to the state that you lived in and where your state stood on these issues, and then your community, then your social life. And then at the very center of the circle is the human. And it is the human truth there that I was after. You can never know what really happened. There's so many nuances for religion and speech that you could never get quite right. But the things you can count on are the universal things, how it feels to lose somebody that you love dearly, to be afraid, to be anxious all the time, to not be able to trust, to be happy, to fall in love. All of those things are what connects us to the past. I taught an African-American history at the high school one time, and the kids were sort of apathetic, you know. They were studying civil liberties and everything, and that's a good thing. I was glad. But when I told them that the history that I was talking about happened within 3 miles of their school, the connection was made, and their eyes lit up, and that's what I was looking for, this connection with all of us.
Now, of course, obviously, the most famous character in the book that you have is Harriet Tubman. And I think, as a matter of fact, which is a phrase I've seen before, which is, you know, when the good old ship of Zion comes along, be ready to step aboard, clearly meaning it's ready to escape. Tell me a little bit about how you came to create her character. We see glimpses of her. We don't see a lot of her, but we do see enough glimpses of her. She's almost as if, it's not that she's not real, but she's sort of a spirit of something that's going on in the community, rather than, even though she's real, rather than just simply an individual.
You know, Harriet Tubman, I'm sorry to say that her history was really laid by the side. And if it were not for the church where she was connected, that church really kept alive her spirit. Growing up as a kid, I mean, I read about Harriet Tubman, but not in a history book. It was always in a children's book, or kind of a legendary figure. And I did keep her as sort of that legendary figure in this book. So much has been written about Harriet Tubman in the past few years, and a lot of that is because of John Creighton's research, and many books have been written now in the recent years about her. I could not compete with that without her taking over the whole books, but I did feel that her spirit permeated the Black community and gave them hope, and that was what helped them carry on. But she's a delightfully colorful figure.
Right. I mean, it's at one point, I mean, I think there's a saying where if anybody turned back, she'd shoot them.
That's right.
she would know.
No compunction about that at all.
Very practical.
Yeah, yeah. She knew what she was doing, and she felt that God was on her side. And God spoke to her when she had her lapses where she would fall asleep because of the injury to her head. So she had a direct hotline to God, and she really believed that he spoke to her and helped her get through.
Now, this is really a book about sort of generations, because obviously you reached to Maddie. And one of I guess the paragraph that I thought that kind of summarized the book, I mean, as it were, this is a section where this is Elizabeth. Perry has already died. Her husband has already died. And it reads as the follows. It says, "The old days, Perry. She'd go to his place in the field as the sun rose and tell him everything. His spirit would be pleased. All she knew was that he was not in the white man's heaven, nor in the black man's either. She believed in the physicality of things, especially in change, as it caused the body to turn to something the earth could use and be replenished by. A giving back. Memory, the images that stayed behind the eyelids could be God. She didn't know, but in the end, it was enough to know something was left. In time, she would experience the great change, as her people called it, and her spirit would be with Perry. And what would be left of then? The children, and what she tried to teach them about survival. She'd shown them how to hold together and work their land. What it meant to be free." Mm-hmm. Do you think that essence of this community that's this family.
You got it.
I found it in all those paragraphs, but I mean, it seems to me, because it seems a struggle, particularly all the characters, it seems there is a struggle that goes on.
There, the last paragraph of the book, the land, the 22 acres, which I am still living on, I felt very connected to this person, Elizabeth, simply because I was in the exact same setting, and it did not change much over the years. And I put the land back into Eastern Shore Land Conservancy, and she just says at the end, "Now I'm done looking back. I can look ahead. I see trees growing on Elizabeth's field, their roots holding Elizabeth's and Perry's bones. Deer come, and fox, and hundreds of birds. And everything what went away is coming back, covering everything over with life. And what's left is the story. Pass it along with yours. The telling keeps us understanding things."
We've been speaking with Barbara Lockhart. She is the author of Elizabeth's Field. It's a novel about a group of free blacks who lived in Dorchester County during the 1840s and 50s, based on the lives particularly of some real folks there, and I think probably illuminates, I think, some certain amount of history. Someone once said that if you want to know about history, you read history books. If you want to know what it was like to be there, you read historical novels. I think you achieve it. Thank you very much for stopping by.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Day can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.